Chapter 12. Into the night, into the mountains. The Trans-Atenate Express. A prompt from the dead.
No, said Crezia. No. No way. No.
This isn't up for debate, Crezia. It's not a suggestion. It's an instruction.
How dare you order me around like one of your staff lackeys, Eisenhorn? I am not leaving.
I opened my mouth, then closed it again. The brutal murder of her man Fabes was causing her great distress. Getting through to her would be hard. I turned to Amos and Alina. Get dressed. Collect up everything and stow it in the flyer. I want to be away from here in under half an hour. They both hurried away. It was difficult to know how long the Janissary had been gone. Fabes, whose body Amos had covered with a sheet, was still quite warm, so I reckoned Tal only had an hour's head start, 90 minutes worst case. Given his Vessarine pragmatism, I figured he had headed straight for a Vox station to report our location to his brethren. That's what I'd have done in his position. He could have tried to kill me himself, but by then he knew not to underestimate my abilities. There was a decent chance I'd have taken him down, in which case the secret of my location would never have got out. No, he'd gone to find means of sending the message. It was impossible to know how close elements of his party were, but if we were still here in 60 minutes' time, I didn't much rate our chances. It also occurred to me that once he'd got his message off safely, he'd be clear to come back and have a try at me himself. I took Crezia by the hand and led her back upstairs. Her eyes were puffy and red, and she was a little vacant with shock. She sat on the end of my bed as I got dressed. "If I could just go, Crezia, I would," I said softly, finding a fresh shirt. "If it was just a matter of walking away and removing all my crap from your life, that's what I'd do. But that's not what's going to happen. Mercenaries will be heading this way. They will be arriving soon, probably before dawn. They will question and kill anyone they find. You won't be able to tell them you don't know where I've gone. They will... well, they're Vessarine Janissaries, and they're being paid well. I can't leave you here.
I don't want to go. This is my home, Gregor. My damn home. And look what you've done.
I'm sorry.
Look what you've damn well done to my life.
I'm sorry. I'll make amends. She got up, the anger coming back and eclipsing her sorrow.
How? How the hell can you make up for this? How the hell can you make up for all the pain you've ever caused me?
I have no idea. But I will. And you have to stay alive so I can. I've got the ruination of your nice, comfortable existence on my conscience, Crezia. I will not add your death to that.
Fine words. I'm not coming. I'm going back to bed.
I grabbed her by the arm and stopped her. I had to find a different tack. As a medic, she was almost professionally selfless. Appealing to her sense of self-preservation was futile.
I need you to come.
That's the truth of it. I've got to take Medea with me. I can't leave her here, and I don't think she's in a position to travel.
Of course she isn't.
So she'll die?
If you move her now? In her state?
Better she travelled with a doctor then, don't you think? She shook off my hand.
I will not allow you to jeopardize the health of my patient, Eisenhorn, she warned.
Then consider the prognosis, doctor. If she stays here, she'll be dead by morning. They will kill her when they find her. If she comes with me, without you, she'll likely die too. I think what's really in question here is your Medicaid oath to preserve life. I hated being so manipulative. Well, with her, anyway. She regarded me with venom, knowing that I'd cornered her.
You bastard. You clever, clever bastard. I don't know why I ever loved you.
I don't know why either, but I know why I loved you. You always cared. You always did the right thing. She turned and walked out of my room. I finished dressing and tucked spare clothes and barbarisata into a leather grip I found on top of the wardrobe. Then I picked up the rune staff and stopped in the doorway. The Malus Codicium was still in the drawer of the nightstand. I wrapped it in a pillowcase and tucked it into the grip. How could I have nearly forgotten it? The first answer that occurred to me was strange and unnerving. Perhaps it wanted to be forgotten. The flyer's interior lights illuminated a patch of the little courtyard. Amos and Alina had stowed everything, clothes for each of them, and the manuscripts and books we had rescued from Spaten House. I put my own stuff aboard and ran a pre-flight. The flyer was charged to optimum.
Help me, damn you all, Crezia said.
She was dressed in a dark green utility suit and a quilted coat, and had two travel bags with her. Medea lay on a grav gurney, strapped in place with a Resuscitrex unit and a Narthesium full of supplies magnetically anchored to the underside of the gurney. Crezia had slaved two med skulls to our patient, and they hovered in the air behind the stretcher. We got Medea aboard and then clambered in ourselves. Crezia sat beside Medea, saying nothing. She didn't even look back at the house as we rose into the night and powered away. We flew south, towards the main Atenate range, a massif of gigantic peaks that split the center of the continent for 3,500 kilometers. The Itaval and its neighbors were just foothills compared to this great geological structure. I didn't want to stay in the air for too long. Tal knew we had a flyer and would have informed his comrades. This was just a short hop to get us going. I studied a chart slate and began to compose a route. By dawn, we were about 90 kilometers to the southwest and several hundred meters higher, in the base valleys of the ragged-edged Assembo. It was a soaring black shape in the early light, with a glinting wig of ice. Its mighty neighbors lurked behind it. We set down at a town called Tairoir, a small place that thrived as a logging center and a way station for travelers heading to the resorts at the top of the Assembo Pass. I parked the flyer on the edge of the town under a brake of firs that would shield it from aerial observers. No one had said much. The air was briskly cold, and I'd turned the cabin heater to maximum for Medea's benefit.
"We should eat," Alina said.
"I'd go and get something, but..."
None of us had any money. Crezia pulled off her gloves and produced a wallet from her coat.
"Am I the only person who thinks practically?"
she commented sourly. Alina took a credit bar from Crezia and walked down through the trees into the town. She came back 15 minutes later, carrying a styrene box in which were 4 tall sweet cafites in disposable flasks, hot pastries in waxed paper wraps, a loaf stick, and some vacuum-sealed sausage meats. She'd also bought a mini data slate loaded with a touring guide of the region.
"I thought it might be useful," she said.
"Great," said Crezia. "Now we can pick the best spots to ski."
While Alina had been gone, I had spent considerable time and effort freeing the flyer's side hatch. It had been bolted open in military style for the permanent gunner position. With the weapon stowed and a fragile human cargo, I wanted the cabin sealed. It would pull to, but the latch wouldn't engage. I tried brute force, but I don't think it had ever been closed in its entire service life. We ate and drank in silence, and the med skulls administered sustenance for Medea via the fluid drips. I watched the sky and the long arc of the road into the town. There wasn't much traffic. A few utility vehicles and mobile drones, the occasional fast speeder. All tourists heading for the resorts. While I ate, I scrolled through the guide Alina had bought. We left Tairoir at 9:30 and spent the rest of the day flying further west, around the shoulders of the Assembo, over the mirrors of the high lakes and on towards the northern resort of Grudge. For a long time I was convinced we were being followed by a small, yellow speeder. I became so concerned that I diverted east, around a tract of mountain pasture and steep forest. I lost sight of the yellow craft, but about 30 minutes later picked up a black one that shadowed us steadily at a distance of 5 kilometers. My anxieties returned again. In the late afternoon, as we flew in towards Grudge, the black flyer turned south on a route that would take it to the spa resort of Firiol on the southern face of Mons Fulco. I had been jumping at phantoms. At Grudge, I landed the speeder in the cover of some pines southwest of the old city wall. I took Crezia's credit bar and walked into the town alone. Grudge was an old town with a meandering plan like Ravello, but it was far less picturesque. Slot bars and dance parlours occupied the main thoroughfares, and there was a busy stream of young, vacationing Gudrunites on every street. I found the local chambers of the Adeptus Astra Telepathica, a tall, black-windowed structure on the corner of the main square, and went inside. A careworn female adept called Nissint debited my credit bar and provided me with access to the Aegis account. I wanted to check if anything had come in during the last day or so. I was in for a surprise. There was a communique from Harlan Nail. He had survived. His message was quite long and written in glossier. The gist of it was that he had left Messina 2 weeks earlier suspecting, for reasons that he didn't go into, that something bad was afoot. That didn't surprise me. Nail had a nose for trouble. That he, of all my poor lost agents, had been forewarned of the danger was easy to believe. He was, at the time of sending, just 3 days shy of Gudrun. I had the adept send a reply, also in Glossier, telling Nail to head for the southern capital, New Givet, and, once there, to arrange passage off-planet. I asked him to confirm and told him I would send again when I was close. 4 days was my estimate. 4 days, and we would be with Nail at New Givet and heading off-world. The Snowtrack was essentially a luxury recreational vehicle. A well-upholstered cockpit and adjoining cabin, housed in a sleek grey hull and carried on a main track power unit with thick forward wheels for steering. The rental agent was in full flow, singing the machine's praises when I cut him off. I'll take it.
A sound choice, sir.
2 weeks' rental. I'm driving to Entry, and I'll be leaving it there.
That's fine, sir. Deliver it to our offices in Entry. There's a little paperwork to fill out. You have means of identity?
Crezier's credit bar soaked up the cost of the deposit. I wanted to keep the transaction fairly anonymous. I used the rental agent's palm reader to rouse another of my slumbering fake identities. Torin Gregory, a vacationing Thracian businessman with ample funds. The dealer seemed satisfied. The Snowtrack was a hefty brute with a surprising kick in its heels. I drove it back out of the town towards the Flyer, stopping on the way to stock up from a grocery market. My friends at the Flyer regarded my approach with caution. I discovered later that Alina had had her las pistol drawn and ready. I leaned out of the cab and waved at them. "Get yourselves aboard. We're switching vehicles." We left the empty speeder under the trees, and as soon as Medea was safely positioned in the plush, leather-padded cabin, I headed out towards the pass road. I didn't tell the others about Nail. I didn't want to get their hopes up. By nightfall, we were powering up the snow-dusted highway over the pass towards Entre. Grudge fell away behind us. I thought I saw a small yellow flyer approaching the town as we left, but it was too far away to be sure. We drove through the night, taking turns at the wheel. The weather was clear, and the cockpit vox was tuned to the climate casts to catch snow advisories. Crawling up the northern hem of Mons Fulco, we ran through steady squalls of snow and had to drop speed and use the main lamps. Crezier was driving at that point. She'd lived in the mountains for long enough to know what to do. I napped in the cabin, resting out on the long bench seat opposite the still-sleeping Medea. I dreamed about her again, dreamed about saving her. Yekud Vance was in my dream too. Desperate for my help. He screamed, bawling out a spear of sound and sigh pain that woke me. I blinked over at Medea, but she was still stable. Alina was asleep nearby. The cabin rocked and vibrated with road noise, and snow ghosts fluttered past the windows.
"Are you all right, Gregor?"
Amos asked. He was sitting on the bench seat at the back of the cabin, surrounded by data slates. "A dream, that's all, Uber. It woke me last night, too." I paused and sat up. The previous night I had assumed I had been woken by the sounds of Tal's escape, but now it had happened again. The dream had woken me. Woken me both times. Yekud Vance's terrible death scream of pain and rage and frustration. We rumbled into Entre in mid-afternoon the following day. Heavy snow had slowed us down, and ice caked the copper roofs of the famous resort. But heavy snow had also brought the winter sports crowd into town in great numbers. The place was buzzing with activity, the roads sluggish with vehicles, the skies flecked with arriving speeders. I drove the Snowtrack into the parking lot of the Entre Transcontinental Station and found a place. Amos and I went up to the concourse building where Torin Gregory purchased tickets for 3 connecting sleep berths. The express was due in an hour, we were told. Just as the mighty Atenate range creases the centre of Gudrun's largest continent, so the Trans-Atenate Express runs like an artery along it. The railway is famously romantic. Most who ride it do so because of the ride, vacationers who would rather travel than arrive. The young flock to centres like Grudge and Entre to use them as a base for skiing and ice surfing. But the wealthy choose the Trans-Atenate, where they can sit in coddled luxury and watch Gudrun's most spectacular scenery slip by outside the window. The great chrome promethium-fueled locomotive pulled into Entre at 5, pulling a string of 10 double-decked carriages. Porters helped us to manoeuvre Medea aboard. Our cabins on the top deck of Car 3, a wagonlee, were first class and spacious. We put Medea in one of them, with Alina to one side of her and Crezia to the other. Uber and I shared a fourth. There were communicating doors between the suites, and everything was finished in polished maple. The express hooted its siren and panted out of entree, muscularly taking the gradient into the Fonet Pass. The huge silvery beast could reach 170 kilometres an hour on flat sections. I regarded the timetable, overnight to Fonet, then a short stretch to Locastra, followed by a high-speed, uninterrupted run all the way down through the Atenate Majors, across the southern plateau, to the coast. We would be in New Givet in just under 3 days. There was barely any sense of motion, a slight rolling vibration that one swiftly became oblivious to. The cars were robust, thick-skinned, heated, and insulated against the Atenate chill, but the side effect of this was to virtually eliminate exterior sound. The massive engine, deafening from the vantage of the platform concourse at entree, was virtually inaudible. Only when the express hammered down a cutting or a gorge and the engine noise was compressed and channeled backwards by the steep sides did we catch a whisper of it at all. With the cabin blind down, I might have been at home in a comfortable parlour. While daylight remained, I kept the blind up and was afforded panoramic views of the pass, the snowfields, pink and soft in the sunset, the hard-shadowed scarps of rising ice broken at the folds by knuckles of black rock. Once in a while, beige smoke from the engine streamed past the windows and obscured the view. On slow turns, it was possible to lean across to the window port itself and see the foreshortened flanks of the cars and train ahead, segmented like a great snake, the chrome and blue and white livery catching the last of the sun. Twice, a long, jumping shadow of the train ran alongside us across the snows. Night fell, and the views outside vanished. I drew the blind. Amos was snoozing, so I thought I might walk the length of the train and get to know the layout. The communicating door opened, and Crezia came in. She was dressed in a grey satin robe with tightly laced pleating that ran from the high throat right down to the top of the gathered skirt. A fur wrap was draped over one arm, and she had put her hair up. I rose from my seat almost automatically. "Well?" she inquired. "You look stunning." "I meant well, as in, isn't it time you escorted me to dinner?" "Dinner? Main meal of the day? Usually found somewhere between lunch and a nightcap?"
"I am familiar with the concept."
"Good. Shall we?"
"We are fleeing for our lives. Do you think this is the time?"
"I can think of no better time. We are fleeing for our lives, Gregor, on the most exclusive and opulent mode of travel Gudrun has to offer. I suggest we flee for our lives in style."
I went into the bathroom and changed into the most presentable clothes I had with me. Then I linked arms with her, and we strolled back along the companionway to the dining van, 3 cars back.
"Did you bring these clothes with you?" I asked quietly as we wandered down the softly lit, carpeted hallway, encountering other well-dressed passengers walking to and from the dining van.
"Of course. We left in haste. And you packed a gown like that?"
"I thought I should be ready for anything."
The dining salon was on the upper deck of the 6th car. Crystal chandeliers hung from the arched roof, and the roof itself was made of armour glass. It doubled as an observation lounge, though just then it simply provided a ceiling of starry blackness. A string quartet was playing unobtrusively at one end, and the place was filling up. The air was filled with gentle music, clinking silverware, and low voices. Discreet poison snoopers hovered like fireflies over each place setting. A uniformed steward showed us to a table by the port side windows. We studied the menus. I realized how hungry I was.
"How many times, do you suppose?" she asked.
"How many times what?"
"Years ago, when we were together, you would come to visit me in Ravello, secretive as is your manner. How many times did I suggest we took the express through the mountains?"
"You mentioned it, yes."
"We never did, though."
"No, we didn't. I regret that."
"So do I. It seems so sad we're doing it now out of necessity. Although, I might have guessed I'd only get you on a romantic trip like this if you had to do it."
Whatever the reason, we're here now. I should have put a gun to your head years ago. We ordered potage velours, followed by sirloin of lowland runca, roulade with a macedone of herbs, and forest mushrooms, afriol, and a Chateau Zandier from Sameter that I remembered was a favourite of hers. The soup, served with mouth-watering chapon and a swirl of smetane in wide-lipped white dishes, delicately embossed with the crest of the Transcontinental Company livery, was velvety and damn near perfect. The runca, simply pan-seared in amasek, was saignant and irreproachable. The Zandier, astringent and then musty in its finish, made her smile with fond memories. We talked. We had decades to fill in. She told me about her work and her life, the interest in xenoanatomy she had developed, the monographs she had composed, a new procedure for muscle grafting she had pioneered. She had taken up the spinet as a means of relaxation, and had now mastered all but two of Gazella's studies. She had written a book, a treatise on the comparative analysis of skeletal dimorphism in early human biotypes. I almost sent you a copy, but I was afraid how that might be misconstrued. I own a first edition, I confessed. How loyal! But have you read it? Twice. Your deconstruction of Turkson's work on the Dimamar A sites is convincing and quite damning. I might take issue with your chapters on Talanopithecine, but then you and I always did argue over the out-of-terra hypothesis.
Ah, yes, you always were a heretic in that regard.
I felt I had so much less to give back. There was so much about my life in the last few years I couldn't or shouldn't tell her, so I told her about Nail instead.
This man is trustworthy?
Completely.
And you're sure it's him?
Yes, he's using Glossier. The beauty of that code is that it's individually idiomatic. It can't be broken, used, or understood by outsiders. You'd have to be in my employ for a long time to grasp the fundamentals of its mechanism.
That bodyguard, the one who betrayed your household.
Kronsky?
Yes. He was in your employ.
Not for long. Even with the basics he'd grasped, he couldn't dupe me for long using Glossier.
So we're going to be rescued?
I'm confident we'll be able to get off-planet.
Well, Gregor, I think that good news calls for an indulgent dessert.
The steward brought us ribot de nappe, sticky and sweet, followed by rich black hesperine caffeine and digestifs, an oaky amasek for me, and a thimble of pasha for her. We were laughing together by then. It was a fine dinner and a good night spent in delightful company. I have not known its like to this day. I was woken by the jar and the thump of a halt just after dawn. Outside, a whistle blew, muffled by the car's hull, and there came the distant mutter of men's voices. Slowly, I slid out of bed, doing my best not to disturb Crezia. She was still deeply asleep, though she rolled over and reached, murmuring, into the cooling space I had just vacated. I tried to find some clothes. They were strewn on the floor, and with the blind down, it was a matter of touch. I prized back the edge of the blind with one finger and peeked out. It was already light, frosty and colourless. There was a station outside and people milling on the snowy platform. We had reached Fonette. I got dressed, shivering. Now the train was halted and idling. The wall vents issued a cooler wash of air. I opened the door and slipped out, casting one last look behind me. In her sleep, Crezia had curled up into a ball, cocooning herself in the bedsheets, shutting out the cold and the world. Outside it was near freezing and very bright. The wide platform was busy with passengers leaving or joining the express, and servitor units conveying pyramids of baggage. Snow was lightly falling. I hugged myself and stamped my feet. Several other travellers had got down from the train to stretch their legs. Fonette station occupied an elevated area above the town, shadowed to the north by Mons Fulco and to the south by the Utes, Minor and Major, and then the weather-veiled bulk of the central Athens. "How long do we stop?" I asked a passing porter.
20 minutes, sir," he replied. "Just long enough for changeover and for the tender to take on water."
Not long enough to run down into the town, I figured. I stayed on the platform until the boarding whistle sounded, and then stood in the carriage hallway, leaning out of the doorway window, as we slowly pulled out of town. The station building slid by, revealing a view of the town below that had not been visible from the platform. Steep roofs iced with snow, a ministerium chapel, a sturdy Arbites blockhouse. a landing field just below the station causeway, filled with berthed and refueling flyers. One of them was small and yellow. I went back to Crezia's cabin, took off my coat and boots, and lay beside her until she woke. She rolled over and kissed my mouth.
"What are you doing?" she asked, sleepily.
"Checking the timetable."
"I don't think there are any changes on this line."
"No," I agreed. "We'll be at Locastro in about 4 hours. There's a longer halt there. 45 minutes. Then the long run to New Givet." She sat up, rubbing her eyes. Drowsy, unguarded, she was more beautiful than ever.
"So what?" she asked.
"I'll check the astropathic account there. There'll be time." There was a knock at the door. It was the cabin service steward with a laden trolley. The last thing we had done the night before was to order a full, cooked breakfast. Well, not quite the last thing. Elena and Amos were up, taking breakfast together. Crezia pulled on her robe and checked on Medea, who was still stable and sleeping deeply.
"The signs are good," she told me on her return. "Tomorrow, perhaps the day after, she should be back with us."
We ate together in her cabin, picking up our conversations from the night before. It was all familiar and relaxed, as if we had adjusted our clocks by 25 years. I realized how much I had missed her company and vitality.
"What's the matter?" she asked. "You seem preoccupied."
I thought about the yellow speeder. "Nothing," I said. During the long, slow climb up through the Utes to Locastra, I went through the data slates and material Amos had compiled since the attack on Spaten House. I paid particular attention to the name Kanyar the Sharp. Amos had compiled a list of planet cultures where the word Kanyar was still in parlance. 9,500 worlds, and I went down the list systematically, even though I knew Amos, with his greater knowledge of trivia, had already done so. Any one of them might hold the key. A Kanyar was a ceremonial oathing dagger on Benefax, Luess, and Kraton. It was the slang term for a ganglord on distant Mechanique. It was the common word for a pruning knife on 5 worlds in the Scarus sector alone. It was a Hive Argo adjective for sharp practice on Morimunda. On 3,000 worlds, it was simply the word for knife. A knife cutting me to the quick. Who was Kanyar the Sharp? Why was he diligently seeking my destruction and the destruction of my entire operation? I turned to consider the slate listing the injuries he had dealt against me. The deaths he had, I'm sure, ordered. They were all still shocking to me. The sheer scope of his murderous efforts astounded me. So many targets, so many worlds, and all struck at the same sidereal moment. I found that I kept coming back to the notice of Inchabel's death. It was, simply, the odd one out. Every other victim or location target had been a specific part of my personal organization. But Nathan Inchabel was not. He was, had been, an inquisitor in his own right. During my campaign against the heretic Quixos, almost 50 years earlier, Inchabel, then holding the rank of interrogator, had been part of my team. He had joined my fold after the death of his master, Inquisitor Roban, during the atrocity on Thracian Primaris, and had continued to aid me devotedly until after the purge of Quixos's stronghold on Farnus Beta. After that, with my sponsorship, he became an Inquisitor and began his own work. Since then, we had been in contact only a few times, and, apart from our old friendship, there was no connection between us. Why had he been marked out for destruction, too? Coincidence was not a good enough answer. What connected us? Who connected us? The obvious name was Quixos, but that led nowhere. I had eliminated Quixos myself. I ran through the list of worlds again, trying to discern a link. One of the planets named on the list was Quenthus VIII. The name snagged me like a protruding claw. Quenthus VIII, a margin world. I had never been there, but I'd once been told about it. Running on instinct, I cross-checked Quenthus VIII with a vast list of worlds on which Tare or Tari was a registered surname. Amos had already cross-referenced the lists of worlds using Kanyar, with worlds owning the surname Tare, and had come up with 700 possibles. Now I was able to add sense to one of them. There it was. Kanyar was the word for a war knife on Quenthus VIII, and Tare was a clan name from that world. Nearly 350 years before, one of the most vile sociopaths in the Imperium had started his career on Quenthus VIII. Marla Tare's reported claims to have been born on Gudrun had been discounted by Amos, who had checked the census and found no sign of the name. He hadn't gone back far enough. He hadn't gone back 3.5 hundred years. I did, and found that Tare had been a peasant name on Gudrun until that time. The family tree ended right there. I knew who it was. I knew who my enemy was.